AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Dow Automotive Systems, improving durability and increasing design flexibility with Betamate structural adhesives at DowBetamate.com.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 36 for Thursday, December 17, 2009. Done got 'em. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern or 2400 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free. Try searching for AutoLine After Hours at the iTunes Store. Well, here we are, AutoLine After Hours. This is going to be the last show of the year because next week being Christmas Eve, I ain't coming in here to work. I don't think you're coming in here to work. You're not coming in here to work.
We should get a magnum of Ubiquico, set it on the table, and just have a rip-roaring show.
That could be fun, but I have family commitments. But
bring joining
us, as ever, Peter DeLorenzo.
Jim.
The auto extremist.
Good to be here.
Front and center.
Good to be here as always.
David Welch with Bloomberg Business Week magazine. We've got to insert that. And our guest today is master spy photographer Jim Dunn. Jim, it's great to have you joining us here.
It's good to be here, John.
AutoLine After Hours. Mm-hmm. Hey, you sent us a number of spy shots, sort of collector's item spy shots. And Ben Sanders here put that up on our website. And we're running a contest right now. You can go to the John's Journal page at AutoLineDetroit.tv, and or you can go to bit.ly/afterhours, bit.ly/afterhours, and we've got three spy shots of heavily camouflaged cars. Some of the camouflage is outright goofy. And you, please, try to identify what these cars are in. We're running a little contest. We're going to pick from the names of those people who get it right a winner, and that winner will get a T-shirt. So we'll announce who the winner is at the end of the show. If you haven't entered our you know, instant contest here, we'll announce who the winner is later on tonight. So, Jim,
you might make a tiebreaker out of this.
Okay.
In addition to identifying them, you could say, well, what model year is this, and where were these taken?
Oh, my God.
No, they're not. Wow. No, wait a minute. It's, for me, it's easy, except for one of them. The black one?
Yeah.
I don't think anybody would guess where that was taken.
No.
We but
can't
I'll
even guess
hint.
What the car is.
I'll give a hint.
Okay, give a hint.
It's 150 miles north of Sault Ste. Marie.
Oh, my God. That's Canada.
Good going, John.
Yeah. So tell us about the whole spy photography thing.
Well,
were you the first spy photographer ever, or was that Bob Irvin,
or
who?
I think other people had taken pictures. But, you know, I was thinking, how did I get into this business? Well, I was a writer for a magazine, automotive magazine, and I had a bunch of kids and a family to bring up. And as all you guys know, it just doesn't pay the bills. So I thought, I better get something else, do something else. And I started taking pictures over the fence at Milford, in Dearborn, out at Chelsea. And then I don't know if you want to talk about this now, but when I was taking pictures of the Chrysler Proving Grounds, the Desert Proving Grounds in Phoenix, I noticed that there was it's all fenced off all the way around, 3 miles by 2 miles by 3 miles, big hills and tracks and everything inside. Well, at the Chrysler place, there was a section that Chrysler didn't own that went right into their proving grounds. Like, say this, the proving grounds section went in like that. And it was there for years. I saw it maybe 6, 7, 8 years.
Wait, hold that thought a minute. Because, Ben, I know you've got a picture of that, an overhead shot of that Chrysler proving grounds. So, yeah, here, you can pick it up on
right there.
Yeah. On there. So it's like a little finger of land, a little finger of land that sort of juts into the proving grounds.
All right, here's a section of the proving grounds. Here's their high-speed track. It's a circle, yeah. Highly banked. And these are test roads. This is access roads here. This is a test road that comes up, if you can see that little line there. rectangular line. That's the piece of property I was talking about.
Well, their test road came up to my property. I bought the property eventually, went around it, and then continued on the test. So they're not 20 feet away on either side of me, right through the fence. No bushes,
yes.
Nothing. And you, oh, here's a close-up, and you can see that. That's.
So you own that piece of land right now?
No, I sold that for an unconscionable amount of money.
So you bought it
That's
on...
That's why I'm grinning.
You bought it for nothing because it was the middle of
well,
nowhere.
Well, it was $24,000. It's 4.42 acres, $24,000. Yes, I stole it, and being a Catholic, I went to confession because it's stealing, you know, by something like that. Eventually, Chrysler sold the Proving Ground. They don't own it anymore. They sold it for the largest money land sale in the history of the state of Arizona for
$528 million.
$528 million.
Yes, that just sold it in like 2004 or something like that.
How do you remember that?
Because I remember doing their earnings and they were talking about the profit they made, and I dug down and said, wait a minute. A big chunk of this is from selling a patch of land in Arizona.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys, you're not making that much money.
Well, it's about 30 miles from the, what do they call it, Skyport or whatever the airport is down there in Phoenix. So finally, one year, I'm down there. I used to make trips down there and take pictures through the fence. As soon as they saw me, of course, the cars had stopped running. And there was none to hide. There was sagebrush and a couple, Palo Verde trees, but nowhere to hide. I'd take a picture, and they had it marked
private property.
In fact, I'd sent one of these pictures into Popular Mechanics when I was working there. And the artist ran to the editor of the magazine. He said, we can't run this. This is private property. The editor says, it's okay, Jim. Jim owns that property. So anyway, I sold it for 4.42 acres for $130 an acre. And you want to know the price, I'm so sure. $573,000.
So you made a hell of a good return
on that
investment.
So I went to confession again because that was really stealing. But I've taken, if the truth be known, I took very few pictures there in that particular spot. And if the truth be known, again, the reason I bought it is because every time I drove by there, I thought, what's this going to be like in the future? And I thought if I was riding in the car with any of you, I would have pointed and see that piece of property over there. I could have bought that for pennies. I'd be a rich man. That's when I decided I'm going to buy it. And when I bought it, it happened to be a for sale in an estate. And the estate was in California, and everything was done by phone. And I took a mortgage out on my house, paid cash for it. Wow. So that's the story of the Chrysler Proving Grounds. Now, Chrysler sold that for that huge amount of money.
Yes, it's like $528 million or so.
And they had a layout. I went down to the proposal to the city government down there. They wanted to surprise Arizona to incorporate the grounds in their city. And they had two grade schools, a high school, a fire station. But right in that one piece of property where I was, they had... because the city government wanted them to do this. They had marked this off for employment. Big strip. That property is on a road there. And employment means big buildings, car dealers, hospitals, maybe a mall. That's where my property happened to be, and that's why I got the high price for it.
That's so terrific.
That's the story of
okay,
that.
Okay, well, we're done here tonight. Let's go have a drink.
Sorry to... But then I have pictures taken from all over. Those three that you saw were taken in, two in Detroit and one way up north.
So and what's your most memorable shot?
Well, my very best shot is a blue Corvette on a curve. And are you running those pictures or not?
Yeah, maybe Ben can pull that up. Blue Corvette on a curve.
What year?
On a curve, it's got... the hood is blacked out, so you know it's a mule. You can see all four tires.
Here it is. There. We got that up on
That's
the screen
right now.
That's
my favorite picture of all time.
Why so?
And I know it's
it's a little bit
dull. It isn't absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
ZL6.
I just shoot him. I don't. You can't see. It's got a pitot valve up here.
Mm-hmm. The fifth wheel on the back.
Look at the size of those tires.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tipped, and it's moving at high speed. And you can see spy shot in it. So that's my favorite. I think I took that about 8 years ago. So you can see why I'm so happy with that. And the ugliest car I ever took was the current Sebring Ford-R.
Well,
and I took that down at Phoenix.
Thing's just horrendous anyway.
Well, here you go.
Here it is.
Yeah.
And I hired two artists. I said, take all the disguise off and make it look good. Well, I couldn't get a good picture. And these are first-rate artists. Couldn't get a good picture of it. And I never could sell a artist conception of it. So that one is my worst.
What was the hardest one for you to get?
Well, when I went inside.
Tell us how you did that. How does a spy photographer go inside a car company to take spy photos?
Well, my job was on the line. If I was caught trespassing, I'm sure one of the auto companies would say, what kind of guy do you have here breaking the law? And
they could prosecute you.
Yeah, and I'd probably lose my job.
Why? That's what you're supposed to be doing. I mean,
you know, that's exactly what happened. I went down to...
and I'd pay your legal bills.
A friend from one of the auto companies called me and said, Jim, General Motors is having the mother of all clinics down in Dallas. And they're having it Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And if you go down there, I think you can get in and see it. Well, and these clinics are the auto companies. You all know what
they are. Quite elaborate.
He said...
Where do they have it, like in a building or a stadium?
And usually in a conference center, like
say
a small town Cobo Hall, like Rosemont, Illinois, they'll have a little conference center. And it's all secret, and when you go up to the door, they have people at the door. They're checking your ID. They have sent out letters to a list of possible buyers or people in that market. And so I can't get in from the front door. Well, this fellow he's from Ford's. He said, if you go down there, tell us when you're going. We'll have a car for you at the airport. This is Ford for the GM. Now, I wasn't selling the pictures to Ford. But when they were published, Ford could see them. So this is all in my book. I'm giving away the whole book.
Oh, well, we'll talk about your book in a minute, but finish this story. It's too good.
Well, I went down there. I couldn't get in. The hall was divided in two with a big sliding door between the two. One was empty, and one had all the cars in. Well, I got my Minox out and my clipboard and shirt and tie, big shot, you know, don't bother with me. And I walked in the empty hall, and I could see through the wall. There was a little opening there, and I took my Minox and was shooting like this. I couldn't quite get the shots I wanted.
Minox, of course, being a dinky little camera.
Big as my finger.
Really?
Yeah.
Haven't you ever heard of a Minox?
Yeah.
But you try and operate a Minox with a clipboard in one hand, looking this way and the other, and you have to go like this every time you shoot.
Yeah, it's a little slide.
And you have to aim it. And if it's the least bit off, you miss everything. Anyway, I wasn't satisfied, but they were moving out the next day. And there was a parking deck next door that was open, of the type you see around Detroit. The side, there's no glass, it isn't enclosed, and you can go up to different floors. Well, I went up two floors, and I looked, and this is where I was going to shoot it the next day. But that night, I thought, I got to get in there. So I'm waiting outside, and I see these people walking to the clinic. They're parking the car in the back. They had to walk all the way to the front of the building, get into the clinic. As they're walking in the front, there's a side door that's open, but there's a guard there. And so they stopped at the side door, and the guard says, no, you have to go around the front. And I'm watching all this. I couldn't wait any longer. So it started to rain, thunder and rain terribly. So I went out and stood in the parking lot for a while to get soaking wet. I had a suit on, a shirt and a tie, get soaking wet. And I walked up, I walked up to the door where the guard was, and I put my hand on the upright where the door is, and my other hand was here. I think I had my camera in a pocket here. And I'm breathing hard like this. He comes up. Are you all right? I says, boy, it's a long walk out there. And he says, come here, sit down. I sat right down, and he sat me right down in his chair, which was inside the door. And right over to the right is a new Caprice, that rounded one. So I'm trying to get the camera ready, watching this guy. And then at every car, the clinic would have an interrogator who would walk you around and say, do you like this? Do you like that? And how about this? Do you have any comments? Well, I'm watching the interrogator, and I'm watching the guard, and I'm watching the car. And it worked out. Finally, the guard says, I'm going up front. Tell the folks. I thought, oh, that's the end of me. So I got a couple
more. He saw you take a picture, you mean?
No, he didn't see me. I'm an old guy with rain all over me, and I'm panting hard and holding my chest.
Well, I don't know how old you were. You left that part out?
No, I wasn't old at that time. But anyway, I left, and they knew I had had them later when the pictures appeared. And they knew, even though I didn't say anything wrong, I didn't tell a lie. I got up on that parking deck the next day, and they moved those cars out one at a time into the broad daylight to load them on the vans. It was perfect. I had my car right next to me. The parking deck was empty because, you know, it was kind of out in the suburbs and nobody was parking there. So that was the big coup. About a year and a half later, they nailed me at Rosemont, Illinois, in a similar clinic. And I won't make a long story of it, but the hired guard there said, can I help you, sir? And I thought, oh, gosh, now I'm caught. So I said, no, I'm just looking around. I didn't have my camera on me, and I was outside of the Oldsmobile. It was an Oldsmobile clinic. And he says, you're going to have to show me some ID. I says, I'm in a public place here. What is this? He says, I have your picture right inside my booth. So they nailed me. They held me. And you talk about editors who say, that's where you're supposed to do your job. Rosemont's just outside of Chicago. I was held there for 2 hours, sat in a chair in the middle of the reception area. The captain of the police department came. And I knew by that time they couldn't do anything to me. And he said, you planning to stay in the Chicago area overnight? And I says, I don't think so. I think I'm going right back to Detroit. This is about 9 o'clock at night. He says, I'd advise you, if you're around the area, don't get a hotel in Rosemont. I said, yes, sir. In other words, get out of town at sundown. So all the way home, I drove home 5 hours back to Detroit. I couldn't sleep that night. The next morning, the very first thing I did was call Joe Oldham, the editor of Popular Mechanics in New York. I said, Joe, ran into a little trouble last night. Joe's from Brooklyn, Italian guy from Brooklyn. And he says, what is it? I said, well, they nabbed me in Rosemont, and they didn't give me a ticket or anything, but, you know, they got my name and everything, and they stopped me. And I thought, well, you know, be serious business for the magazine. Jim, that's what we hired you for. That's what we want you to do, is get out there. Exactly what you said. So the all's well that ended well. But those are just two little incidents.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That is cool. Is that the most pissed off any of the car companies were ever at you, or was some shot that came out where they just hit the roof?
It's a double life. You know that I covered the auto industry for 45 years as a journalist. And at the same time, I'd be invited into their styling studios, into the proving grounds, test their cars. And it was a double life. In fact, I went to...
And you put on your ninja costume with the camera and you're
that's right.
creeping over the wall.
I'm going to the men's room. And never reappear. But another incident, I was at the GM Proving Grounds out here at Milford with a bunch of journalists, and we were going to go out on Black Lake and see the new cars. And the head of security of the GM Proving Grounds came out and gave us a little pep talk. Wear seat belts. Stop for stop signs. Don't go on to Black Lake without permission. And don't go over 100 miles, that kind of stuff, 100 miles an hour. And he says, you know, I'm giving this talk to you people here, and I notice one guy looks familiar. He's the guy sitting there with the tie. And I knew it was me. He says, I couldn't quite place him. Then I remembered, I have his picture posted in my office, right? So it's kind of a double thing. Yeah, they would get upset with me. But they just treated me like, well, like an ordinary journalist.
I still remember at one of the Chrysler long leads where they had like the Jim Dunn Memorial chain link fence.
Chain link.
So if you wanted to take a picture of one of the new cars, they would roll out this chain link fence so that you could make it look like a spy shot.
I took all my pictures that year through that chain link fence at that preview.
Race with the security guys chasing you down?
Yeah, I have had them. I have had them follow me in a car.
Wow.
But I'm always on public roads. So.
Sure. Well, look, they do get upset. I went down and did a story years ago on Honda when the plant in Alabama was pretty new. And I told them I wanted to talk to some workers, you know, see if, you know, talk to them, ask them if they would be receptive to a union, the UAW, and this sort of thing. So Honda says, oh, yeah, no problem. So they get a couple of workers, and they sit me at a lunch table with them with an HR person and a PR person there. Yeah, I'm going to get straight answers out of these people on the UAW with the HR person and the PR person there. So, you know, I went through the motions, asked them the questions. They told me how lovely it was to work there. Okay, fine. So I finish all my interviews and everything at about 2 o'clock, and, you know, shift change is at 2:30 or 3 or something. So I just sat in the parking lot and waited for the shift change, workers coming in, and I start interviewing workers about the union and all that sort of thing. And one of the workers told on me and said, there's some guy out there talking about the UAW. So I interviewed about 8 or 10 of them, and I'm literally in the car, and I'm about to leave the site. And these two security trucks come up behind me, and they pen me into the parking space. And the guy comes up and says, are you with the union? I said, no, I'm not with the union. He said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm supposed to be here. I was interviewing people. And he said, well, someone said there was a union person parking lot. I said, I know what they're talking about, but that's not why I'm here. And he said, well, we're going to have to keep you here. And I said, hang on a second. And I said, your badge says security guard. You're not a cop. You can kick me out of here if you want, but you cannot detain me. You let me go. And he said, I'm not letting you go until I fight. I said, you're going to let me go, or I'm going to ram your car with this rental. And then the PR guy is sprinting out of the front door. So he said, let him go. Let him go. And then Ed Miller at Honda made up this thing that looks like the front page of the cover of Business Week. And it has a Honda Accord on it, and it says, David Welch's parking space, do not block. Good at any Honda facility in North America.
So, Jim, what's this book that you're working on?
Well, the name of it, the book is, I'm not working on it. The book
it's
is
done?
Finished.
Yeah. Oh, good.
The name of it is Car Spy Secrets, and the subtitle is Including Photos of 100 Cars You'll Never Drive. And did we show those cars earlier?
The spy shot ones,
yeah.
Or that were the contest
those
ones?
Those are three of them.
Okay, well, here we got one right now. Don't give it away, because this is one of the contest cars that we want people to guess what it is. That's
well,
another
that
one
gives
of them.
It away.
Well, that you should thing. Know, but and that one, too. That one's a little guess. Harder, I think.
You'll never guess in 1,000 years.
Where that was shot, you're saying.
Yeah, where it is.
But so, the and it's all
oh, the book is finished. I'm looking for a publisher. And
okay, anybody out there listening, watching,
right.
If you're a book publisher, if you got an agent that you know, sic them on Jim Dunn.
that's where I am now. I'm going to wait till after the holidays when things calm down.
That's a nice shot right there.
Mm-hmm. Hold that one.
Yeah, hold that one, Ben.
Identify that car.
It looks like a Ford on the front end to me.
Well, unfortunately, I left the blue oval on the front. Yeah.
Well, maybe that's
good.
What gave it away
well,
for
good.
Me.
Good. You're an expert. that car has not seen public road. And there's a couple others.
Is that something current?
No.
That's all, okay.
Current? It has not seen the public road.
No, I mean, is it like a recent?
Within
concept?
2 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now this is a artist rendition based on a camouflage shot of the vehicle
I'm
that you?
I'm not telling you what it's based on. But I have a few of those, some Cadillacs, mm-hmm. that I have not been released yet.
So, hang on. So you go to press. I see you at press events all the time.
Yeah,
and the PR people don't give you a bad time, knowing full well that I mean everybody knows you're a spy.
What PR guy is going to try to give me a bad time?
So, but nobody has.
No, they don't give me a bad time. In fact, I think they use the pictures of the competitor. They'll see them in Automotive News or somewhere. They'll take them into their studios. At one time, I heard that that cab forward Dodge was pasted on the board at GM Studios, life size, so they could study what the camp, this is a radical design at the time,
mm-hmm.
so they could study what that thing looked like. Henry Ford, when he saw one of my pictures of the a disguised back end on an 82 Seville. Remember, it had that broke back design on mm-hmm. the trunk?
The bustle back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He says, that's the design of the future, and that's what we're going to have. Well, George Peterson at the time was designing the Lincoln Continental four-door. And if you notice, that one has that same design.
Right.
He says, damn you. You ruined my design. I had a beautiful Lincoln Continental, and when Mr. Ford saw that, he says, that's what we got to have. It ruined the whole thing. To this day, we'll be sitting at a table, he'll throw a napkin across at me. So a lot of people are involved in it. Now, I mentioned a person from Ford tipped me off to the Dallas and said, we'll have a car for you at the airport. Well, I didn't send the pictures to Ford, but the pictures appeared, say, in Popular Mechanics, and Ford would get them, GM would get them, everybody would get them.
You get a lot of... Go ahead.
You still have... I mean, what's the state-of-the-art spy cam for a man in
I'll
your
I'll tell you,
profession?
The cameras today are so fantastic that it's... I think you can pick up a camera for $250 and it'll do just about everything you want except the long-range stuff, real long-range stuff. Although, are you up on cameras?
No.
Well, I'm not going to ask you then.
Good.
I know
they're a lot better than they used to be.
Well, not only that, but I see them 15 or 20X, it says, and that means 20 times.
Mm-hmm.
Kyle.
I know. It's amazing.
That?
It's amazing.
And the cameras are no bigger than this. Yeah. But I'll tell you one thing that really gets me about the new cameras is when someone will show up and they'll go like this with the camera. Amateur. So, I think
you
they do it to
holding
make
the camera and moving it all around,
yeah,
like they're really setting a shot.
Shoot it,
right.
Shoot it, you know.
Right.
I think they do it on purpose, just to agitate me.
What do you use for a long-range shot? Because
I have a 500 millimeter lens.
But you have to kind of sneak around and run around.
Well, I'll be out in the field or out. Okay. That one picture was taken, and you can see snow in that. Don Sherman, who was editor of Car and Driver at the time, called me up and said, Jim, you got a picture of that Corvette? I said, no, I haven't got it. He says, well, it's wintertime, middle of winter. He says, we really like to have a picture of the Corvette. I says, should I go out there? He says, Jim, we'd kill for a Corvette. Well, what are you going to do? So I went out there, and I was in one chopped-down cornfield, and I saw this Corvette go by with the fifth wheel on the back. And I had to go about a mile through the snow to another location because I knew it would be running back and forth on the north-south straightaway. And that's how I got those real clear shots of that. It was a crisp winter day, you know, clear, no smog. And that blue car, you see kind of a dusty look to it. Well, that's all the atmosphere, dust in the atmosphere. So in the wintertime when it's clear, you get sharp shots.
Hey, we need to take a short break here because we have to welcome our sponsor for the show, Dow Automotive Systems, which you can find out a whole lot more about at DowBetaMate.com, Beta, BETAMATE. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about that Dow's got is what they call their Aerify diesel particulate filter. It's pretty interesting because Audi actually was the first one to ever use this particulate filter on their R8 and then later the R10 race cars, which they just cleaned up in the American Le Mans series, cleaned up at Le Mans.
At Le Mans.
And Peter, have you ever heard of a race car having any kind of emission control contraption of any sort on it?
Well, no. I mean, Audi, clearly, we've talked about Audi before. I mean, their focus, consistency over the last decade, that they were hell-bent on elevating themselves to Mercedes and BMW and actually exceed them. And they're one of my coming brands. I mean, I've identified Audi as one of the brands of the next decade. They are going to eclipse BMW and Mercedes. But they put their engineering might where their mouth was and decided to run a turbo diesel at Le Mans to, you know, prove their TDI technology. And, of course, Dow played an important role because the Lamar organizer said, well, you can run diesels, but if they're smoking, we're not buying it. And that's how, you know, obviously Dow got involved, and a tremendous technology in those TDI race cars. I mean, just
what's amazing about this particulate filter too is the technology that they use actually came out of beer filtration. They've got these like little.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. Germans.
Yeah, beer, diesel. Yeah. Why not? Yeah.
It all works. You know.
Right. But, yeah, so, I mean, Audi kind of flipped when they saw that this technology was available because it doesn't cause a whole bunch of back pressure, which you don't want in a racing engine, you know, real good flow. And
They don't lose a lot of efficiency because that's one of the problems?
No, that's what's amazing. In fact, I was at the first race where that engine ever raced, which was
Sebring.
At 12 hours of Sebring, and they literally did the white gloves check at the end of the race, went there, you know, swiped the inside of the exhaust pipe. No soot on the white glove, and that's all thanks to that
amazing
filtration. And
they use it in the Peugeot, the winning Peugeot.
Right, beautiful car. Stunningly good-looking car.
Fabulous car.
Audi's got the fastest, most durable one, but the Peugeot is just gorgeous.
And they won Le Mans last year.
Yeah.
With the Peugeot.
Right.
A picture of the Peugeot?
We might have that coming up, too.
But, yeah, so kudos to Dow.
And, you know, with the push on to bring diesels into this market, too.
Watch for your Betamate energy drink.
Right. Well, this is what they call Aerify, A-E-R-I-F-Y. And, you know, I think it's, you know, technology like this that just.
Well, and our friend Johan was at it again this week.
Johan Denison, the president of Audi of America.
Speaking in front of the Washington media saying, you know, hey, you better be careful of this electrification train because, you know, there are a lot of problems and, you know, you ought to focus on what we deliver, which is diesels, high mileage, and, you know, he makes a good point. I mean,
well, there's a little bit of a backlash starting to bubble up against the hype and buzz over electrics plug-ins. I mean, the National Research Council put out that study this week saying that, you know, plug-ins aren't going to sell so well in the next decade because, you know, they could cost as much as $18,000 per vehicle more. And, you know, is this really the way to go? And, I mean, now, some of these councils, you wonder about their politics. But it's a good point. I mean, this stuff's very expensive.
Well, that was Johan's point. Johan's point said you're going to have to pay people to drive these cars.
Right. Well, his point was let the marketplace decide.
Yeah.
Don't have the government picking technology.
Yeah, because, well, in Washington, California, the politicians, I call them the finger snap brigade. Oh, we'll fix this with a finger snap. We'll write a check. The people will buy them. We'll all be buzzing around in our shiny, happy, smiley cars and, you know, emitting our perfume exhausts or whatever. And, you know, it'll all be good. But it doesn't work that way. You just can't convince them that, hey, you know, people are going to buy what they want to buy, and if it's a real headache to deal with the electrification of the automobile, they're going to say no. And if you're in a big city and you're in New York, guess what? You're not driving an electric car unless you have a garage and you have access to power, because even if you have a garage, some guy's going to say, hey, what are you doing? Well, I was going to plug in my... No, you're not plugging your electric car. Get the hell out of, you know. It's just not going to work that way. And I hate when politicians start, you know, shoving it down, you know, our throats, instead of, like Johan said, let the market decide. We've graphic demonstration of that in 08 when gas was $4 a gallon. All of a sudden, yeah, that was that, you know, that accelerated, eclipsed any CAFE standard the country's ever seen before. All of a sudden, people made decisions like, well, let's see, $95 to fill up my excursion? I don't think so.
You know, what's interesting about that, though, is that if you run those numbers, hybrid and small car sales really peaked when gas hit like 376. Gas kept going to 409 a gallon last summer. And you saw the share of the more efficient vehicles start to go down. And what that tells you is after you had the people
after
went out.
After the shock
panic,
wore off.
Yeah,
wore off.
After the shock went off. People were still buying more efficient cars than they would
sure
at $2,
mm-hmm,
clearly.
Sure.
But after the shock wears off, things start to normalize a bit more. And, you know, I've run the numbers. It, you know, you look in Japan last year, the average fuel price was $5.35 a gallon, and in Norway it was like $7.80. The average car sold, real world fuel economy, was 31 mpg in Japan and 35 in Norway. So
That's the kind of fuel economy people in Europe and Japan actually buy at much higher prices. And it's great fuel economy, but it's not what people think. I mean, you know, getting 35 by the middle of next decade, you're going to need pretty high fuel prices to get people to buy that. And then Europeans and Japanese consumers have the added incentive that, you know, roads are tight and parking is really tough. So buying a smaller, more efficient vehicle, they've got other incentives that we don't have in this country, and they still only got 31 at $5.35 a gallon. It's telling.
And speaking of incentives, Chevrolet came out with a song for the Volts and a dance for the Volts. Ben, can we bring that up? Can we show folks what this song and
the whole song
and dance? Here we go.
Future should be a big adventure. Instead, our world is under pressure. Everyone's talking about making a change. The cost of fuel and mileage range. Together we face this new frontier with mysteries to solve, oh dear. What will get us out of first gear? A better EV. Now that's a big idea.
Okay, that's enough. That's about as much as I can take of that.
Looks like a jib-jab.
Oh, my God.
They use the word cheap in the lyrics, too, and there ain't nothing cheap about the Volt.
No, no, no. Yeah, the electricity might be cheap, but it's a whole lot. Yeah, who did that? I mean, to me, it is abysmally bad.
Well, I sent you that. Chip, you read that. The explanation was it's originally written for kids.
Right. Okay.
And I don't know how it made the transition, but boy, what a train wreck!
GM didn't actually produce that, did they?
They had that playing at the LA Auto Show.
Oh, I wasn't there. So they actually agreed to that. Oh my God!
Yeah,
that is abominable.
You know, and here we are at a place where GM can't afford any publicity misstep, PR misstep. Mm. You know, here the LA Show. In a hostile market, in a hostile region that's anti-GM anyway, they're basically out of business there except for trucks and Corvettes and whatever.
A jingle that sounds like it's from Barney and Three Women Who Look Like They're Not Even High School.
And not only that, they've got the media, they've got some pretty nice new cars, LaCrosse, the Regal, and what do? They announce that Fritz has just got fired.
Right.
You know, they couldn't have waited 3 days. They could have made up something and sent Bob out there and say, Fritz isn't feeling well.
Right. And I'm laughing not because Fritz got fired. I'm laughing because of what you're bringing up. On the eve of the auto show, they sacked the top guy.
And so immediately all their product news is gone. So they can't afford any misstep, and that's one. And then this comes out. Now, granted, you know, pre-YouTube, pre-video days, it would just be a laugh at the auto show, and you'd forget about it. Not anymore. Everything's got a shelf life.
What was the point of that?
It was supposed to get kids excited about electric cars and the Volt, and somehow it got transferred to the Volt display at the LA Auto Show.
But, you know, and talking all about these green cars, now Honda's got egg all over its face. I don't know if you guys have followed this class action lawsuit against the Civic Hybrid.
Oh, yeah, because the people bought it said, well, it doesn't get the mileage you said it was going to get.
Right, because it's rated at, like, 49 city, 51 highway, and all these people drive it around, they're saying, I only get 32 miles to the gallon. Yikes. And so they did this class action lawsuit against Honda. And Honda agreed to send them a DVD with driving instructions on how to get a better mileage.
Start at the top of a hill.
Yeah. Put it in neutral. Don't turn on the engine. And then they gave you $1,000 towards the purchase of a different Honda. But that did not include the Fit and some other cars that people might really want to get if they're coming out of a Civic Hybrid. And so 26 state attorneys general said, uh-uh. This ain't good enough. And the other thing that really stuck out in my mind is the state attorneys general said the lawyers are going to get $3 million. The 150,000 or whatever the number is of everybody involved in the class action lawsuit, they get to split $22,500. So, I mean, this is, I think, big-time embarrassment for Honda.
Honda's hybrid program is
not doing well, shall we say. I've got a piece in the magazine this week. I mean, the Insight sold 1,400 last month. It's being outsold by Prius about 6-1.
Well, everything's being outsold by Prius.
Yeah,
six
but
to
this
one.
Was supposed
this
to
was
be,
supposed to be the answer to
and,
the Prius.
Yeah, because
you're right.
This was the only one that was hybrid only. It was cheaper than a Prius by a few thousand.
They've done so
dollars.
Well up to now with just straight economy on straight engines.
Mm-hmm.
You'd think, well, they'd be wizards at a hybrid. But if those tests run 49 and 51, that's verified by the federal government or endorsed by the federal government, right?
So, well, I know, but as you know, the federal test cycle is a certain amount of acceleration, deceleration, yada-da-da-da. And, yeah, you can actually model your calibration to eke out the best fuel economy for that test cycle, but that may not work match up with the real world. And I think Honda got caught on that. The other thing that I find very interesting is the key reason why Honda has not done a strong hybrid that you can drive on pure electric power is Toyota's pretty much locked up the patents on that, pretty much.
Oh, is that right?
And there ain't no way in hell that Honda's going to license Toyota. I mean, they'd rather slit their throat than do that.
Honda's system is lower cost. Well, originally was lower cost than Toyota's. You know, the Prius system is in its third generation now, and they've amortized that cost over a million Priuses sold, plus whatever they've got with, you know, Camry and the other ones they're selling. They've got the cost down for a system that's a lot more robust than Honda's. And, you know, you say everything is outselling, you know, or being outsold by the Prius, sure, but this one is also selling at about half the rate that they planned. They wanted 40,000 in a year, and they're barely going to hit 20,000 this year.
Although it's selling well in Japan, or it was selling well in Japan, so
yeah,
that may help.
But the other thing is, okay, so they're on pace to sell about 20,000 Insights this year. They wanted to sell 40. They sold 243 Civic Hybrids last month. So yeah, it's also the people who wanted to buy Civic Hybrids are buying Insight, but their total hybrid sales, you know, are in the tank. I mean, they're not moving them.
Are you guys aware of this company called Pace that is suing Toyota for patent infringement?
No, yeah, we've talked about this. It's an American company.
It's an American company, and believe me, this story ain't over yet.
What's the patent?
In fact, you'll know the guys that were involved in this, Jim. Bob Templin used to be chief engineer at Cadillac. Ted Lucas used to be chief engineer at Oldsmobile. And a guy named Bob Oswald, who ran the Bosch company in this country, they joined up with this Russian guy who invented this whole thing. There's an Australian company that did an in-depth patent search on worldwide on all the patents involved in hybrids. They came up with nearly 20,000 patents. And then they went in and did this deep dive analysis of it, and they said, okay, here's the top 500 patents. And then they went in and did a deeper dive analysis, and they said, okay, here are the top 10 patents. You cannot do a hybrid without these top 10 patents. Pace has four of the top 10, including the top two. Toyota only has one patent on there. Ford's got one. I think Nissan's got one, and some other company as well. So, we'll have to do a whole show on that one at some point.
Because Toyota might be on the hook.
They very much will be on the hook, is my prediction. I'm not a lawyer, you know, so. But it's a fascinating story. More to come.
And where are they located?
Pace, actually, they've got an office. I think it's here in Livonia, down the road here.
Get them on the show.
I know, but, you know, I think we will get them on the show. I think we will.
If the lawyers let them talk, right?
Well, you know, they're trying to do this without horribly embarrassing Toyota. They're just saying, hey, we got the patents, pay us.
Yeah.
And they've been, you know, they're all guys out of the auto industry. They don't want to go screw Toyota. So they've been a little bit quiet about it. But I wonder how quiet they'll be, you know, in the coming days here. But, hey, enough of that. We'll have to get into that again in more detail at another time. It's time for Rapid Fire. You know who that is, Jim? Jason Vines.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding. So this is Rapid Fire, where, you know,
whoa,
we've had
Jason.
All kinds of questions and comments come in from our viewers.
Yeah.
And so here, Pedro Fernandez is the first one. He says, hey, Jim, when you took a spy shot of the Aztec, Pontiac Aztec, Was the camouflage better looking than the actual vehicle?
That I think would be number two for least attractive car that I've ever seen. I don't know why they produced it like that. Do you have any insight on that?
Yeah, we do, but that's like a whole show under
the
title.
A whole story on it in the magazine. The quick and dirty is they had a cool concept called Project Bearclaw, and it was an aggressive crossover SUV that looked very cool.
Actually, it was the first crossover concept. The concept of the Aztek was brilliant, and it was the first one.
Yeah.
They just couldn't execute it.
No.
Well,
they didn't have a platform.
They didn't design it with a platform, so the manufacturing guys under Hackworth stuck them with the U-Van platform, their old minivan, which turned it into a bread box. And then, you know, back then, brand management basically said, you know, it's a Pontiac, so Pontiacs back then were just hanging plastic cladding off of other GM vehicles. They had a Buick version of it, so you had to wrap up this bread box that already had some aggressive styling elements, cladding and talons and all the other things that Pontiac had, and voila, Diary of a Compromise, and a really, really bad one.
Ding, 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 time's up. Okay, this one you ought to know. It comes from Redondo Beach. It says, ask Gino. That's your nickname? Gino.
That is I.
Okay, which photo paid for one term of his daughter Patty's education at MSU? And she's watching Autoline After Hours right now.
Patty, one term. Well, let's say it had to be Corvette, because expenses at MSU are pretty high, aren't they?
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, well, I had three in college at that time.
Holy moly.
I don't know which was which. Let's say a Corvette. Let's say red Corvettes are always nice. And let's say whenever she went to school.
What's the most expensive picture you ever sold?
I sold a group of them for more than $10,000. But they're all the same genre. I hate to use that word. I have a couple of them here.
Okay, we're moving on. It's rapid fire. You got to go fast on this.
Sorry.
Rich says, I saw an article which speculated that since Chinese manufacturers are looking for an entry into the U.S. market, one might try to buy GM when it issues stock again. Any comment?
Well, we'll have to talk to James, Sonny Fu, and Fu King Motors, you know. If anyone's going to do it, it's going to be my pals at Fu King Motors.
Dave, any thought on that?
Another of my kids just wrote a story for the Wall Street Journal saying, why did GM sell 1% of its 50-50 share? And his analysis is that they were in trouble with money. Well, I'll let him tell the story, but that was strange.
But this could jeopardize GM's position in China.
Well, yeah.
Which has been a pretty strong
Whoever position. Owns the 1% runs
right.
the company.
Is that Michael, right. your son? Yeah, yeah, he's brilliant. He really knows the Chinese market.
He takes after his father.
Okay, Porsche Girl writes in to say, does GM have a product line or a car that will save the company? If not, what do they need to do?
They've got some really good stuff coming. I'm probably going to... They showed us some stuff for Chevrolet last night that I thought was really good. Since they actually talked about it...
The new Malibu, we can talk openly
about.
The new
Malibu
I
thought was really cool.
Why talk about the damn car that's going to be 2 years out?
How many years have they said that? Oh, we got something coming that's really nice.
Well, I've written about it for 10 years. That's... Just wait and see. Yeah, we got some great stuff coming around the corner. Just... Get it out.
There is some manana factor. Mm-hmm. But I thought the Avail looked great, too. GM has really good design right now. Speed is the issue.
Well, Ed Welburn, who's running GM Design, I think that guy really knows how to run design studios.
Yeah, Ed and his crew are top-notch.
By the way, we were bad-mouthing the Cruze last week. Not a game-changer, but it looked better when I saw it last night than...
There's nothing wrong. Right?
It's competent and handsome, but it ain't. There's no electricity.
Needle a whole lot for me.
No charge when you look at it.
Still stylistically not as good as a Civic or a Mazda 3.
This was my takeaway.
Okay, Jim Haynes says, are the Chrysler dealers complaining to the government really interested in being Chrysler dealers again, or do they just want money for their lost dealerships?
Kind of a little bit of both.
Yeah, that's what I would say. Definitely want money. I mean, these guys got screwed.
Because they can't, you know, they said, well, you get your dealer back. My dealer's gone. My property's gone. You know, these guys are very legitimately furious.
But they do invest in a franchise, and there's no guarantee that it's going to pan out, and this company's been in trouble for a long time.
Yeah, but the way they handled it was really bad.
Okay, Jay Cujo writes in to say, what is the most sought-after photo for an upcoming vehicle? I mean, right now. Mm. He says, I have my money on the C7.
Well, that's a perennial.
Always.
Yeah,
right.
Corvette is
any Corvette, you can always sell a Corvette photo.
But if this was 2 years ago, I would say the four-door Porsche.
Panamera.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Now that everyone's seen this, it's like, yeah. Whoa.
Right. Anything else you can think of right now that, you know, would be a shot to go and try and get?
The problem is they're showing these cars. Like last night we saw a Malibu that's two years away. They're showing all the cars ahead of time. So they're putting me out of business.
Yeah. And everyone thought the Panamera was camouflage. It's just, guess what?
That's it.
Jeremy Jones from Dallas says, how long will Brian Sweeney last at Buick GMC? He is the third leader in a month.
He was just quoted just today. We're all going to be here for good. This is it. You know, who knows?
Well, look, he was actually picked by this new management team, and Big Ed had to sign off on it. So, now Big Ed has no patience either. But, look, I think if you're actually picked by Big Ed or he signs off on it, you've got a better chance of sticking around.
Well, yeah, but they sure didn't do a very good job of vetting Michael Richards, the guy who only had the job for 8 days or whatever it was.
At that point, he wasn't the CEO. He's the CEO right now. I don't think any people in there right now, as much as that guy gets his hands on management, are in there without him knowing it and reviewing the vetting process.
Well, Sweeney's 42, and he's been there, and he's one of them. He'll be there for a while.
I think you're right, too, actually. Okay, George from Brooklyn wants to know, what do you guys think of the Aston Martin Signet? I don't even know it.
Oh, that's the Toyota.
Oh, the IQ.
The Aston version of the IQ. There's photos of it. They released it. It's got an Aston front end on the IQ with an Aston interior. It's like, let's blow up our brand image. Just right. Go ahead. Let's go right ahead and blow it up real good. But, you know, their argument is, well, they will use it. Aston owners will use it to run into London.
There it is. There it is. Actually, that doesn't look too bad.
Yeah, it does. Kids have those books with like a zebra's head and a rhino's body and a horse's legs or something. And
then you
did that with like elements of a car and gave it to a third grader.
If you just shell out $120,000 for a Vantage V8 and you're digging it and you see that pulling up and it's got an Aston winged emblem, you're going to just say, oh no.
That's terrible.
That's right.
The grill's bigger than the rest, as big as the rest of the car.
Jerry Hightower asks, what's the cost for the auto manufacturers to add side airbags to a vehicle, and then what is the consumer charged for these add-ons?
I don't know if there's a markup on those, but you look at all the airbags and all the safety stuff on cars, it has raised prices a lot.
Oh.
Now, the usual measurement is if the auto company pays for spark plugs, for instance, they will mark it up 5 times. But I don't think they can possibly do that on all the safety equipment or the cars that cost $10,000 more.
Well, they used to. I don't think they do anymore, but there were a number of vehicles, I want to say about 5-6 years ago, where you could, the side bags were an option, and you'd be charged several $100s for that. So I'll just make up a number and say if they're charging you $200, the cost of the airbag's probably $80. But you got to realize that there's also sensors that go along with it. You had to do all the engineering. You had to do the calibration. You had to do the safety testing and yada-da-da-da. So, okay, you pay a supplier $80, but you're not going to charge the consumer $80. It costs you more to do it than that.
And you're seeing more bags. I mean, so many cars I've seen in the last couple of months now have the knee protection bags for the driver. Mm-hmm. And you're, I mean, which the Kia Sportage had like 10 years ago, I think. But you're seeing more and more bags of, you know.
The last thing I saw was rear side airbags were like a $300 option on something.
Tell you, they just got to cut that out and go to that one Schwarzenegger movie where the styrofoam, the foam comes out of the steering wheel, and then they chip the guy out of the solidified styrofoam. Is it actually?
They have a form if they chip it out carefully.
Yeah, like Schwarzenegger was all stuck in this hardened foam. They had to chip.
I remember
out.
One of the early developments ideas for meeting the bumper standards was putting unpopped popcorn in the bumper structure, heating it. Having it pop inside. Seriously.
Pop safety.
Seriously.
The one I liked was...
They investigated that.
This was in the late 40s. It was right after World War II, 46, 47. Look at that. Ben, you the man coming up with this.
Ben Sanders, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Ben Sanders. He's the man.
All honor to his name.
But, yeah, Ben's brought up the video we were just talking about. But in 46 or 47, somebody came up with the idea of putting, like... retro rockets on the front of a car, so just before an impact, the rockets would fire off so you wouldn't have an impact. Of course, you'd fry whatever was in front of the car. Okay, Mud Monster writes in to say, Jim, did you wave to the testers as you took the pictures?
Well, I'd see the engineers at previews, and I'd tell them, whenever you drive up and down that north-south straightaway at Milford, please smile, because I'm probably taking your picture. So I would wave to some people after I took the picture, like, I'm through taking, don't worry about it, I'm gone, and I'd take off. But I tried not to have too much interaction with those people, and especially the guards out there. If they came around, I just left. Once in a while, I did get in a little flap with them, but nothing real serious.
So it sounds like the PR people didn't really care. The engineers thought it was kind of amusing.
Yeah, but the bosses, they have to yell at somebody.
Were the security guards.
That's their job.
But nobody else cared.
Well, they care, but it's just, you know.
For the record, they care, right?
Okay, here's probably what's going
you
to happen.
I didn't have to worry all those years?
That's what I'm thinking. That's what it sounds like.
This will probably be the last question, I think, that we'll get to tonight. Jason Jajush, and I know I just butchered your name, Jason, but I'm doing the best I can here. Okay, if you were CEO of McElroy Motors, DeLorenzo Motors, Welch Motors, Dunn Motors, in what energy direction would you lead your company if you had to pick that way forward today and petrol is not an option?
So no petrol. Diesel or gasoline.
No diesel or gasoline. Where would you take your
natural gas?
Goodness.
Natural gas. Natural okay. Gas. There's David votes for natural
That's
gas.
Very good. Thank you for that, because I had no answer, but I'm going to use yours.
What I did talk to a geologist about this, and he said that there is a lot of natural gas even in the U.S. But he said if you were to start to turn over a big chunk of the car park to natural gas, eventually you'd end up in the same, and it wouldn't take too long to end up in the same position we're in with oil right now, where prices start to rise again. And mm-hmm. It's a lot cleaner.
Yeah, I like natural gas too, but ultimately I think it's hydrogen. I think we're going to figure it out.
You just want to sell HERF and have
I do, David.
I want to. Hey, the hydrogen car emits pure water.
Water vapor.
And eventually, if you're waiting for a light in the wintertime, you're dripping that water down on the pavement out of the tailpipe.
But I was told it's no more.
And then when it freezes.
So all the slip and fall lawyers would be happy.
There you are.
Well, you didn't hear my. I'd actually go with biomass fuel. I'd go with ethanol, cellulosic ethanol. When you get to liquid fuel, it's still far more energy dense than any gas or hydrogen or anything like that. And even though you lose some fuel economy because of the lower energy density of the biofuel, it's still way more than natural gas or hydrogen.
Well, I like that, too. I mean, cellulosic.
And as long as you're going to be 100% ethanol, you can bump up the compression ratio and just about eliminate any kind of fall off in fuel economy. So that's my vote. That's where I would go. Well, we're coming up to the top of the hour here, and we do have a winner of the contest who identified Jim's cars, and Ben and the guys picked out the winner, and it's Derek Denny. So, Derek, email us your address. Send it to viewermail@autolinedetroit.tv. And you, sir, have just won a T-shirt. Congratulations. So anyway...
So are you going to tell what the cars were?
Oh, well, yeah. What were the cars, Jim?
Well, how could you give this guy...
Well, hold on. Let's get the cars up on the screen here. Ben, if you can... Okay. Now this, we should all guess and then have tell us. Any ideas? I'm going to vote. To me, it looks like a Jaguar XJS. S as in Samuel.
Is that the coupe?
Yes, it was a coupe. It had a nice real swoopy sail panel off the back.
No, I don't know because that was covered up.
And it was in the Whitesnake video.
Say, Peter?
Was it?
Yeah, it was. It was Tony
I actually Cassino. Thought it was an Aston Martin, but what do I know?
I agree with John. I think it's an XJS.
It is. It is a Jaguar, and it's in Timmins, Ontario, Canada, and that's, I think it's 150 miles north of
the cold weather testing.
And I was...
And that's probably what, shot in August?
Yeah. I was shut out of that for a day and a half, no cars, and that's where GM's up there and... Honda has a place up there. Toyota has a place. And I didn't know that the Jaguar was up there. So I, feeling low, I pulled up to a light in the middle of Timmins. What pulls up next to me but this thing?
That's cool.
I mean, there's excitement here. You never know. Anyway, I chased this gal who was driving it all the way around town and got those shots. Then I found out, I followed her, and she pulled into this garage that was on Jaguar Road that I'd passed 50 times before and didn't even notice the name of the road was Jay.
What's the other one?
Okay, let's get the other shot up.
Okay, I'll hurry up. You're not going to show it? Of course. Yeah,
here we go. Well, that's got to be Corvette.
Corvette, but the interesting thing about it is the first time I've seen so much cladding on a car. It was just like a Batmobile. It came out of
it's
the...
It's ugly.
Yeah, really.
Well, they just wanted to cover it up. Look at that. Right? Look at that bumper for... And then the third one is a Plymouth
Prowler
with a Jeep cabin on it.
It looks like a Jeep Wrangler
it
top.
Like Panos A4. Remember the first Panos had the fenders over the front wheels and
And you can see here I shot it through the fence. Those are fence marks down into the Auburn Hills. They have a little test track out there.
That is the wildest camouflage, putting that Jeep Wrangler on top of a Plymouth Prowler. I mean, you can tell in an instant it's a Prowler. I mean, what kind of camouflage is that?
You look at some of these other disguises, and they drive them out on the public road. Well, it says, look at me. I look different. Are they trying to hide them or what?
Well, no, you see them all the time in Detroit.
They jump right out at you.
Right. Yeah, anytime I see a camouflage car on the freeway or on the road, man, I speed to try and catch up to it and look inside and see whatever I can.
Whatever it is.
Even look at the license plate number.
Now, for instance, this one.
Mustang.
How far do you think you could drive that people wouldn't look? What is that thing? Looks like a wedding cake or something.
Right. Well, anyway, we're at the top of the hour. Let's wrap up the show. Jim Dunn, it's been great having you on the
show. Thank you very much.
Really
enjoyed
it a lot.
It's been a pleasure being here with you, gentlemen.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you wore a tie because somebody has to set the standards.
That's right.
You're right.
Yeah, well, David's calling this his Christmas pink. Is that how you said it? Yeah. Okay. David, great having you here as always, too.
Always a pleasure, John.
And Mr. Renzo, great as always.
Absolutely.
Remember, you can always follow us on Facebook.com/OutOfLineDetroit. Find David at businessweek.com.
That's right.
Can find Peter at autoextremist.com.
And if Jim's doing his job right, you can't find him.
You
can't find me, but you'll find my book, which will be out later this year.
Yeah, as soon as we find you an agent.
Don't forget to check out the year-end issue of Auto Extremist, where we have highlights from the year in my column, and then we do highlights of the year and On the Table, which we have a lot of fun with. So, and here's to Big Ed, wherever you are. Good luck with it, pal.
Yep. Thanks again to Dow Automotive Systems for their support of AutoLine After Hours. Visit www.dowbetamate.com
to learn more about how Betamate is reducing vehicle weight and enhancing durability. That's DowBetamate.com. Visit our website, OutofLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Out of Line Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Out of Line Detroit. That's all there, and much more at OutofLineDetroit.tv.